We begin our second hour with extreme news. News too true to be true. Democrats vow not to give up hopelessness. Washington, D.C. In a press conference on the steps of the Capitol Monday, congressional Democrats announced that, despite the scandals plaguing the Republican Party and widespread calls for change in Washington, their party will remain true to its hopeless direction.
We are entirely capable of bungling this opportunity to regain control of the House and Senate and the trust of the American people,
Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, said to scattered applause.
It will take some doing, but we're in this for the long and pointless haul. We can lose this,
Reid added.
All it takes is a little lack of backbone.
Despite plummeting poll numbers for the GOP nationwide, and an upcoming election in which all House seats and 33 Senate seats are up for contention, Democrats pledged to maintain their party's sheepish resignation.
In times like these, when the American public is palpably dismayed with the political status quo, it is crucial that Democrats remain unfocused and defer to the larger, smarter, and better-equipped Republican machine.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, said,
"If we play our cards right, we will be intimidated to the point of total paralysis."
Senator Joe Lieberman, Democrat of Connecticut, cited the Bush administration's bungled response to Hurricane Katrina as a model for the Democrats.
Grandmothers drowning in nursing homes, families losing everything, communities torn apart, and the ruling party just sat and watched,
Lieberman said.
I'm here to promise that we Democrats will find a way to let you down just like that.
According to Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat from Massachusetts, Democrats are not willing to sacrifice their core values, indecision, incoherence, and disorganization for the sake of short-term electoral gain.
Don't lose faithlessness, Democrats,
Kennedy said.
The next election is ours to lose. To those who say we can't, I say, remember Michael Dukakis, remember Al Gore, remember John Kerry.
Kennedy said that even if the Democrats were to regain the upper hand in the midterm elections, they would still need to agree on a platform and chart a legislative agenda, an obstacle he called insurmountable.
Universal health care, the war in Iraq, civil liberties, a living wage, gun control, we're not even close to a consensus within our own ranks,
Kennedy said.
And even if we were, we wouldn't know how to implement that consensus.
Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean had this to say.
Some rising stars with leadership potential, like Senator Barack Obama of Illinois and New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, have emerged, but don't worry, we've still got some infight left in us. Over the last decade, we found a reliably losing formula, and we're sticking with it.
Dean reminded Democratic candidates to
stay on our unclear message, maintain a defensive, reactive posture, and keep an elitist distance from the voters.
Political consultant and Democratic operative James Carville said that, if properly disseminated, the message of hopelessness could be the Democrats' most effective in more than a decade.
For the first time in a long time, we've really connected with the American people, who are also feeling hopeless,
Carville said.
If we can harness that and run on it in 06, I believe we can finish a strong second.
That was from The Onion, America's finest news source. Today, for our People's History section, we bring you a song with some recent history. 3 years ago, next week, Rachel Corrie, an International Solidarity Movement volunteer in Palestine, was crushed and killed by a caterpillar bulldozer while trying to defend the homes of Palestinians. Here's David Rovics with The Death of Rachel Corrie.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? Did did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? This just another day in a dirty war. When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed? One more home destroyed.
That was David Rovics with The Death of Rachel Corrie. We'd like to remind you that this coming Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Dover Friends Meeting House at 141 Central Ave in Dover, the film The Killing Zone will be shown in honor of Rachel Corrie. And now for Steve Diamond with his commentary on Israel's right to exist.
Does Israel have the right to exist? Such a question is completely beyond thinkable for the Bush administration and the Israeli government, but is at the core of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and remains an open question among the Jewish people themselves. If political legitimacy comes from anything other than raw military domination of land, we can apply that standard equally upon all the governments of the world. This is what the Arab people demand, and the U.S. has refused to hear and act upon. A state finds its legitimacy through history, through respect for individual freedom, through consistency to its founding ideals, by not being a threat to the world community, and by the consent of those it governs. At its best, a state is nothing more than a tool of its people to meet their needs for security, arbitration, welfare, and democratic representation of some form, perhaps to the UN or other world bodies. The state is not the source of human rights. They are innate. States are prone to corruption, often manifested through the repression of human rights. A state is supposed to meet the needs of its people, hopefully in the interests of all people and the earth itself. Yet it may be that the state as a system of organization is inherently opposed to the interests of the earth and its people, or that other ways of organizing, such as anarchism, would better meet those interests. Those who seek to redefine our place in the universe as members of God's flock who own the land and promise pie in the sky when you die to those who will work for authoritarians and their ends are exploiting a self-serving parable. They might call it inherently satanic to work for our own needs and the betterment of our lives here on earth, but if government is our best tool for working God's will, I'm certain we're all going to hell. While Jewish history in the area certainly goes back much further, the State of Israel was founded about 50 years ago by the decree of the U.S. and Europe, two anti-Semitic cultures that were willing to tolerate the existence of Jews, at least if most of them were sent elsewhere. Early Zionists actually strongly considered founding Israel in Uganda, or Argentina, instead of Palestine. As has recurred all too often in history, the Jewish people found themselves hated, homeless, and desperate to protect their future. In principle, the Zionists founded their Jewish homeland as a democracy. This has always been an inherent contradiction. The millions of Arabs made refugees from Palestine didn't vote to found Israel. Arabs are preserved as a token minority in the Israeli government that will never be allowed into power, despite the rising proportion of Palestinians to Jews in Israel. The Israeli government maintains Jewish domination by encouraging fundamentalist settlement of the occupied territories, by building roads for Jews only, by occasional massacres by the Israeli military, by denying Palestinians the right to build homes, and then systematically bulldozing homes without permits, and by strangling the Palestinian economy and access to water with the wall, a vast maze of concrete and razor wire snaking all over Palestinian land that makes the Berlin Wall or the Great Wall of China look like a nice white picket fence. Individual freedom has also always been a negotiable ideal for the Israeli government. Jewish protesters and even mainstream American journalists are often attacked by the Israeli military. Unarmed foreign peace activists have been shot or run over. Palestinians are routinely locked in prison indefinitely under mere suspicion of affiliation with organizations like Hamas. Millions of Palestinians who have spent decades in refugee camps are denied the right to return to their homes. Israel continues to ignore dozens of UN resolutions and is bristling with conventional and unconventional weapons, largely supplied by the US. It is the only Middle Eastern country with a nuclear weapons arsenal. If Saddam Hussein was a threat to the world community for occupying Kuwait and perhaps having weapons of mass destruction, why isn't Israel a threat for occupying Lebanon and Palestine and unchecked weapons proliferation? The most likely answer seems to be because Israelis are white and Judeo-Christian. Israel and the American government that has constantly supported it are dangerous, racist, failed states, interested only in cutting Palestine into smaller and smaller pieces and profiting from the domination of the Middle East, its oil, and, with it, the entire world. So does Israel have the right to exist? A fair look at its policies over the past 50 years shows the state has actually lost what little legitimacy it had when Europe and the US decreed it into being. The Israeli people have a right to exist, but they must not be allowed to build their lives and future by denying the Palestinians their lives and future. You can find that column at nhindymedia.org, including an illustration and many relevant links.
That was commentary from Steve Diamond. And now for another report on an action on International Women's Day. This next piece is by Cindy Sheehan. It was published on March 8th by commondreams.org. It's entitled, What Really Happened, Part 2, New York City Style. Yesterday started off like any other day for me. I woke up missing Casey and wondering where in the world I was. After I got my bearings, realizing I was in my friend's apartment in New York City, I got up for my day of meetings, speeches, marches, and rallies. March 8th is International Women's Day, and I was in New York City with a contingent of women from Code Pink, Gold Star Families for Peace, Global Exchange, and some brave Iraqi women to work on our Women's Global Call for Peace. We began our day with a meeting with Kofi Annan's Assistant Secretary General for Gender. We asked her to get a meeting with the Iraqi women and the Security Council. She said we couldn't get a meeting until October, at the earliest. I was appalled because a few of us had just been at UNIFEM in September, meeting with a head of UNIFEM who said if we got a contingent of Iraqi women to the States for International Women's Day, she would make sure we could meet with the Security Council. October is also far too late. People are dying in Iraq every day on all sides as we sit around waiting for meetings and for people to do their jobs. We had two press conferences, one inside the UN and one out. After the outside press conference, where the Iraqi women beautifully, poignantly, and touchingly told their stories, and where we called on the UN to do their jobs as peacekeepers, we marched with our petition to the US mission to the UN. We had a poster-sized petition that has been signed by tens of thousands of women from 78 states from around the world. Our Women Say No to War petition calls for an immediate withdrawal of coalition troops from Iraq. We were chanting as we made our way the few blocks to the U.S. mission. We had a community services officer walking with us. As we neared John Bolton's office, the officer told us to cross the street and wait on the public sidewalk across from the mission. I go all over the country and the world now, saying that it is our responsibility as peace people to peacefully stand up to fascism and suppression of our First Amendment rights whenever and wherever it raises its ugly head. As a matter of fact, I believe that to halt the incredible spread of the creeping fascism and abuse of our civil rights in the country, we are going to need nonviolent civil resistance on a massive scale. When the officer told us to leave one public sidewalk and cross the street and wait like good Americans on the other side, we refused. I told him under no uncertain terms that this is America, and we had as much right to be on the public sidewalk on the U.S. mission side of the street as he did. He said that we couldn't walk down the street carrying signs, a clear violation of our First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and peaceably assemble. We only wanted to deliver our petition, which we had an appointment to do. We agreed that a few of us would proceed forward with the petition, and as soon as it was delivered, we assured the officer that we would leave. Four of us, Medea Benjamin, Reverend Patty Ackerman, Soraya, and I, separated from the rest of the group to take our petition up to Bolton's office. At this point, Soraya, a Kurdish woman from Kirkuk, who lives in the U.S. now, told us that she had been punched in the stomach by the very same community service officer that had escorted us from the rally to the U.S. mission. She noted how ironic it is that George Bush says he is spreading freedom and democracy to Iraq, and citizens of his own country that oppose his own policies can't even walk down the street without being harassed by the police. This is just one example of the hypocrisy and duplicity that reign today in Bush world. Our small group of peaceful women were stopped and told that we couldn't go up with a petition to Bolton's office. We were told that they would send someone down to get it. After many minutes, we were told that our petition would not be accepted. By that time, we had been joined by the other Americans who marched with us, who also demand peace. When we were told that our petition wouldn't be accepted, we decided that we had an appointment, and this was our ambassador to the UN, and we were going to take our petition up. We had been assured earlier that we had an appointment to deliver the petition. As we walked up to the doors of the building, security guards were frantically scrambling to lock the doors against us dangerous women. There were three regular doors and two revolving doors. As one door was locked, we moved to the next door until we ran out of doors and were backed into a corner. That was when New York City's finest went on the attack and forced most of our group and all of the journalists out to the sidewalk. The four of us who got arrested sat down in the corner with our petition and refused to move. We were told if we moved across the street onto the other public sidewalk that our petition would be received. We refused and said we would go to the nearest public sidewalk in front of the building and we would give our petition to a representative of the U.S. mission. That request was refused. We were told if we didn't move to the other side of the street, we would be arrested. We refused to move. After we sat on the cold, hard concrete, and after we had been assured that the Iraqi women were safely on their way to D.C., we tried to negotiate with the officers and security agents of the building for someone to take our petition and we would leave. A security agent for the mission said he would go ask if he could bring the petition up, and he came back and told us that they would not receive our petition, which is another clear violation of our First Amendment right to petition our government for redress of wrong. A bald-faced lie is the lie that we were blocking the entrances to the building. The people who locked us out were the ones who denied people access to that entrance. After our request to have the petition taken up by anybody was denied, we went up to the supporters of peace and nonviolence and the media, and we began to read the petition. I got about halfway through the petition when we were again attacked by the New York Police Department. The officers were being really rough on us, and we four women sat down to avoid being hurt. An officer grabbed my right arm and dragged me about 15 feet along the pavement. The pain in my arm was unbearable. As soon as I could, I got in a fetal position and screamed, "Leave me alone, you're hurting me." The officer then jerked my right arm up and cuffed me, then pulled me up by my arm and cuffed the other arm. As I lay here in bed, barely able to move, writing this, I am again filled with rage and sorrow for my country. What scares me the most is how blatant and rough the people who are supposed to protect us are in the face of cameras and other citizens. It is as if they don't care who in the world witnesses their abuses. They are not afraid of being brutal for the world to see. They are not afraid of any sort of retribution. I am looking into filing charges against the NYPD. Again and again, we must resist the fascism and abuses that we are allowing to become standard operating procedure in this country. That piece was by Cindy Sheehan about her recent experience in New York City on International Women's Day.
I know it's a long, hard climb back to a saner time, so I invite you, friend, come take my hand. Together we'll burn through pain till we feel whole again. Our bodies our own, our minds clear and strong, our souls light and free. Know every woman here walks on and on through fear, holding her head up high and holding her own. Don't give up just before the goddess holds wide the door. Joy comes from pain, light falls again, you know you're all right. Don't make yourself to blame, just take the time to name exactly how hell can feel, so heaven can come, and heaven will come. Hold out your hands in need, the universe will take heed. Open your heart, healing can start, the world's on your side. I know it's a long, hard climb back to a saner time. So I invite you, friend, come take my hand. Together we'll burn through pain till we feel whole again. Come take my hand, I understand, I've been there too. Come on, women, don't give up just before the goddess flings wide the door. Give her your soul, she'll make you whole, and then you'll be free.
That was Libby Roderick with Don't Give Up.
Next, we have Between the Lines from Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lori Allen, a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University, who assesses the obstacles facing Hamas after the hardline Islamic movement's victory in January's Palestinian parliamentary election. Kelly Doherty, co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War, who analyzes a recent opinion poll conducted among U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq. And Alexander Brash of the National Parks Conservation Association, who discusses the Bush administration's proposed funding cuts to the nation's park system that could accelerate deteriorating infrastructure and commercial exploitation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Bush administration is blocking a new proposal for a United Nations Human Rights Council to replace the often discredited UN Commission on Human Rights, which had members from rights-abusing governments like Sudan, Libya, and Zimbabwe. John Bolton, the American ambassador to the UN, wants the proposal renegotiated. The current council bill, which was drafted by General Assembly President Jan Eliasson of Sweden, reduces the number of nations on the human rights body and requires an absolute majority of votes on the 191-member General Assembly to win a term on the council. Nations on the council would have their human rights record reviewed during their 3-year term. The proposal for the Human Rights Council has been endorsed by the European Union and Japan, as well as by organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. In mid-2005, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan suggested a stronger human rights body as a key component of his agenda for UN reform. After Bolton stated the American opposition to the new proposal, Annan told reporters at the UN, "I am chagrined about the US position. Most observers feel the panel will not be approved by the General Assembly without strong US backing." Advocates for the new Rights Council had hoped the new body would be approved before the UN Commission on Human Rights opens its annual meeting in Geneva on March 13th. After responding to a lawsuit by three women, Massachusetts ordered Walmart, which has 3,700 pharmacies in the U.S., to agree to sell the morning after pill by the end of March or lose all the state's business. Walmart agreed to the demands, but upset some women's groups by stating it would allow its pharmacists, who object to filling a prescription for the so-called morning after pill, to refer a customer seeking it to another pharmacist or even another pharmacy. Walmart is expected to enforce similar mandates in its Connecticut and New York stores. Starting in the mid-1990s, pharmacists in Washington state began giving double doses of traditional contraceptives to women who participated in unprotected sex and worried they might become pregnant. Since then, Bar Laboratories, the maker of the morning-after pill, which is effective for 72 hours, had sought permission from the Federal Food and Drug Administration to sell its contraceptive over-the-counter. Despite a positive staff report, the FDA board has refused to act. New York, Maryland, Kentucky, and Illinois are now among states debating selling the morning-after pill over-the-counter. In Maryland's state legislature, an unlikely alliance of anti-abortion groups and the state medical society opposed the bill to sell Plan B over-the-counter. Last year, the bill lost by one vote, but it has been reintroduced for the current session. Students at Yale University typically reflect the diversity of the academically accomplished, but one might not expect to be in a class with a former Taliban spokesperson. 27-year-old Syed Ramatullah Hashemi is enrolled as a freshman in Yale's non-degree students program, Class of 09. His first visit to Yale was in 2001 as diplomatic representative of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. He openly criticized UN sanctions on the Afghan regime and vehemently defended the destruction of the ancient stone Buddhas and suppression and segregation of women in Afghanistan under Taliban rule. However, since the fall of the Taliban, Ramatullah has lived in exile in Pakistan, and longtime friend and benefactor Mike Hoover suggested he study in the United States. Hoover is a former CBS cameraman and a reputed Taliban sympathizer. Although Ramatullah only has a fourth grade education and a GED equivalency diploma, with Hoover's help, he has been accepted at Yale as a special student with temporary status. He now talks of his prior status in the Taliban as an affiliation, has trimmed his beard, and discarded his turban. One of Ramatullah's recent courses of study was titled Terrorism, Past, Present, and Future. In some ways, Ramatullah told the New York Times, I'm the luckiest person in the world. I could have ended up in Guantanamo Bay. Instead, I ended up at Yale. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
Much of the world was caught by surprise when the militant Hamas movement won an overwhelming victory in the January 25th Palestinian parliamentary election. Hamas won 74 seats, while the long-ruling Fatah movement took only 45 seats in the 132-seat legislature. Israel, the U.S., and European Union consider Hamas to be a terrorist group. But these nations differ on how they will deal with a new Hamas-led government that is expected to be formed by the time Israelis go to the polls to elect a new government on March 28th. Israel, which has been the target of numerous Hamas suicide bombers and other attacks, has refused to negotiate with what they label a terrorist government and is withholding millions of dollars in taxes collected from Palestinians. But fearing that the lack of funds would cripple the Palestinian Authority, thereby creating more chaos, the Europeans recently provided $143 million to the Palestinians. However, the European Union says it will not continue to fund the Palestinian Authority unless Hamas recognizes Israel, disavows violence, and honors previous agreements between Israel and the Fatah-run Palestinian government. Conflict between Hamas and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas broke into the open on March 6th when the Hamas majority rescinded legislation giving Abbas increased powers, ratified during the final session of the Fatah-controlled parliament. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lori Allen, a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University, who assesses the hardline Islamic movement's chances for forming a viable government.
I think that as all political parties and all peoples are, the Hamas is full of internal contradictions and internal squabbles, and there's really a continuum of people within the party who have more and less pragmatic views of how to go about governing their people or being part of the Palestinian Authority. And so I think it's really important to keep in mind that it's not a monolithic bloc, first of all, right? Hamas continually affirms that it will not recognize the right of Israel to exist. But what they've been saying more recently is that they won't recognize that under current conditions of occupation. Right? So there's growing sort of pragmatism in their language. And we have to think about, I mean, there are lots of reasons why Hamas and other people don't want to recognize Israel for all sorts of historical reasons, religious reasons perhaps, but also just in terms of politics, that's the political capital that they have because Israel wants to be recognized by the Palestinian people and by Hamas. So this is something that Hamas can hold out on, I think. But Hamas is a lot more than, you know, what U.S. calls a terrorist organization. Sure, they've been part of Palestinian resistance to occupation, and that resistance has taken many forms, including what people refer to as terrorism, but also including basic support for Palestinian people, welfare associations, and they really provided a lot of the services that the Palestinian Authority under the leadership of Fatah wasn't able to provide. So there's all of that going on in what Hamas is and what it stands for. As for its, you know, its ideological leanings and proclamations, again, there's room to maneuver within that. And we can see in the Hamas election campaign, they were very clear to point out that they were not interested in imposing any kind of religious sort of fascist control over the Palestinian people or Palestinian state. So I think it'll be interesting to see which of the different voices within Hamas come out strongest, and that's going to depend a lot on how the international community and funding structures either support or isolate the organization.
Is Hamas a party that can adjust to accepting the Israeli state? Is it implacably anti-Semitic? Is there room for negotiations and a transformation of this party to becoming more flexible and dropping some of the language that many people would feel, you know, advocates terrorism and violence and hate?
Well, it's interesting to look at how in the municipal elections that happened some 6 months ago or so, when Hamas also won municipal seats in places like Kalkilia and Jenin in the north and so on. So in these towns where they're sort of running the show and having to deal with services and, you know, making sure the post office opens on time, they have in fact been dealing with Israel in face to face, right? They've been managing to coordinate over things like trash removal and things like that. So, I mean, just on that level, again, we have to keep in mind that Hamas is a pragmatic political entity, and throughout its history, it has evinced a willingness to bend to various situations. I mean, I don't think they or most Palestinians would see themselves as anti-Semitic. Rather, they're against the Israeli state that's imposed an occupation that has, you know, created incredible sort of economic burdens and various forms of physical suffering and so on and so forth. So all of this has to be seen in context.
What's the role of the United States here? What tact is the U.S. government, the Bush administration, taking towards Hamas? While they still have not formed a government, there's no doubt Hamas will lead that government.
As far as I can tell, the U.S. administration is sort of lining itself up with Israel, as it typically does, and is trying to isolate Hamas. And as one of the Israeli advisors or spokespeople said, they're going to try to starve Hamas out of existence, basically. And they don't say this explicitly, but it seems to be that they want Hamas's government to crumble and allow some reformulated form of Fatah to take over the Palestinian Authority. There is even a new resolution of some sort being introduced in Congress, the Anti-Terrorism, Palestinian Terrorism Act or something, which is going even further than the administration and trying to prevent any kind of assistance going to the Palestinian Authority so long as Hamas is in control. So they seem to be taking a very hardline tack, just trying to isolate Hamas out of existence. It doesn't seem likely that that's going to work, given that so many other countries are committed to letting the world see how this democratic process pans out. right? Because that's what started this, was a free and fair election. So let's see how Hamas manages.
That was Lori Allen, a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University's Pembroke Center. Some of Allen's articles are published in the pages of Middle East Report, which can be found online at www.merip.org. 2 weeks after the bombing of one of Shia Islam's most holy shrines in Iraq, sectarian violence continues to claim victims across the country. Although Iraq has not yet descended into all-out civil war, religious polarization is evident in the makeup of the country's police, where credible allegations indicate these forces are engaged in death squad activity and torture. Despite the increasing violence, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Peter Pace did his best to place a positive spin on the news from Iraq. On NBC's Meet the Press program on March 5th, General Pace said that the war is going in the right direction, a view the majority of Americans strongly disagree with. As the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq approaches, a new poll of American soldiers serving in Iraq reveals that most favor a rapid withdrawal from the embattled country. A Le Moyne College Zogby International survey conducted January 18th through February 14th, 2006, found 72% think the U.S. should exit the country within the next year, and more than one in four say the troops should leave immediately. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kelly Daugherty, co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War, who served 8 years in the Colorado Army National Guard as a medic and MP, including a year in Iraq and 8 months in the Balkans. She analyzes the opinions held by American soldiers found in the Zogby poll.
It's not surprising to me. It's kind of surprising that a poll like this is done and now it's out for everyone to see the results. But you look at 72% of the troops and, you know, want to go home within the next year. So that kind of really, you know, validates people who are saying, we support the troops, we want to bring them home. And, of course, the president and the administration say you can't support the troops if you don't support the war. Well, right now we're doing, you know, what the majority, the vast majority of the troops want is to try to bring them home. And also, I think it really correlates with the 74% of the troops surveyed who are there for their second, third, or fourth tour. So these extended tours of duty on the stop-loss policy where soldiers aren't allowed to get out even after their voluntary contract is expired, I think over 50,000 troops have been affected by stop loss so far. This is really having a bad effect not only on the individuals, but the military as a whole. It's, I think, really losing a lot of its ability to function.
One part of the poll I found puzzling, and maybe I'll get your comment on this. Nearly 9 of every 10, 85%, said the U.S. mission in Iraq is to, quote, retaliate for Saddam's role in the 9/11 attacks, unquote, while 77% said they believe the main or major reason for the war was to stop Saddam from protecting al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, I find that puzzling because certainly I think you, me, and the audience are aware that Iraq really had no role whatsoever in the 9/11 attacks on the United States and really had no role in support of al-Qaeda in that attack or any other attack. So it's puzzling to me that the troops are citing Saddam's involvement in 9/11 and with al-Qaeda as a reason why the United States is fighting in Iraq. What's your comment?
Well, I think it just goes to show how well this administration and I think the military as a whole has gone to misinforming people and keeping them uneducated about what actually is going on. And, you know, I was disappointed when I read that statistic because I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, there's still so many people who are completely misinformed. But from my own experience, before we actually went over to Kuwait, I was talking to my commander and I was saying, you know, sir, I really don't think that this war is right. I am having a lot of moral issues about participating in this. And he said, you know, I have a lot of questions too, but just remember that you signed a contract and a lot of people are relying on you. But then later that night, as he addressed the larger audience of the platoon, he said, if any war protester, anyone says, why are you going over to Iraq? It's the wrong thing to do. Just tell them to remember September 11th and tell them to remember when those two towers came down. So I think just from my experience, there was intentional misinformation being given.
What kind of information do the troops on the ground in Iraq, and in your own experience, what's their sources of information about the news regarding the war and what's happening back in the States as far as policy debates about Iraq?
Well, when I was in Iraq, the Armed Forces Network, which is the military channel, the news program that they showed was Fox News. So just right there, right off the bat, of course, soldiers in Iraq, if they watch the Armed Forces Network, they're not getting a good story. Of polls have shown that people who watch Fox News are less informed and know less about what's actually going on than people who watch, you know, even regular corporate media like NBC or CBS. I know a lot of troops more and more are starting to rely on the internet because the internet is being come more available in Iraq. So, you know, I couldn't say as a whole, but I'd say the soldiers who just rely on the Armed Forces Network are not finding out what's going on or getting a good picture of things.
Kelly, it seems now that the American people in several recent opinion polls, as well as the troops on the ground in Iraq in this most recent poll of soldiers in the field, agree that the U.S. should pull its troops out within the next year. Speaking for your organization, Iraq Veterans Against the War, what's the best timetable that you can put forward for withdrawal of troops from Iraq?
Well, I think definitely the first step to any peace in Iraq is to immediately begin to withdraw the troops. First of all, you know, I would wholeheartedly say that it's completely absurd to say that that's cutting and running or the cowardly thing to do. It doesn't take bravery or strength to stick to a failed plan that's causing huge losses of life and property and costing this country billions of dollars every month. That doesn't take courage. That just takes stubbornness. And I think what a brave thing to do is to say, look, we are trying to do the right thing. Maybe we didn't do the right thing in the past, but we're trying to make it right now. The Sunnis and the Shias that I've met, the Iraqi people who I've met, not in Iraq, but now as a civilian, they've all said to me that they want the U.S. occupation to leave their country today. And they're the ones that have to determine their future. So I think that, you know, poll after poll, the Iraqi people overwhelmingly want us to leave. I mean, they're the ones who've already lost nearly or even more than 100,000 of their citizens.
That was former Army National Guard Kelly Daugherty, co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Contact the group by calling area code 215-241-7123 or visit their website at www.ivaw.net. The National Park Service was the first government agency of its kind in the world. The service manages 348 sites, from Denali National Park in Alaska to historic buildings in the Northeast, including the Freedom Trail and the Underground Railroad. The system currently has a $600 million shortfall and faces a $100 million funding cut in President Bush's proposed budget that will exacerbate the department's crisis. Critics maintain that the White House funding cuts may well be designed to create pressure for increased commercialization, exploitation, and privatization of services within the park system. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alexander Brash, the Northeast Regional Staff Person for the National Parks Conservation Association, a 90-year-old nonprofit organization independent of the U.S. government. Its mandate is to protect and enhance the national parks. He explains how the funding crisis has impacted the whole system and what it may mean for America's national park system if the situation is not reversed.
Since President Bush came in and made a large pledge to help address the backlog for repair work and maintenance in our national parks, at best, one might consider the funding has been flat, and in fact, in real dollars, the funding has been declining over years. And we believe this is, of course, tragic. There's both the near and long-term gaps this creates. One example is Gateway National Park here in New York that covers three counties, stretching actually Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and actually down to Sandy Hook in New Jersey. Gateway was created in the 1970s. It was supposed to be a large recreational area for the 22 million regional residents and ultimately has never really been funded since then. One can go today and still see 1940s Quonset huts falling down. Throughout the nation, this is true in most parks where the $600 million backlog means that roofs are falling down, boardwalks aren't repaired, restrooms aren't open, roads aren't fixed, and so forth.
Just to clarify, people always think of the national parks as the big ones out west, and that goes along with the idea that the main mission of the National Park Service is to preserve our natural heritage. Is that right?
To be very clear, the main mission of the National Park Service is to preserve both our natural and historical heritage. For instance, while there are the great iconic parks such as Yellowstone and Yosemite, which dominate, I think, people's notion of what the Park Service is, for example, here in the Northeast, there are roughly 40 parks, and of those, maybe only three or four have large natural landscapes. Most of the other units, many of the units, things such as Alexander Hamilton's house, which is up at 140th Street in northern Manhattan, the only historic site put aside for founding father Alexander Hamilton, is falling down as we speak. You have Weir Farm, which is dedicated to Weir, who was one of the early American Impressionist artists, and is up in Richfield, Connecticut. And there are, you know, as I said, throughout the Northeast, there are roughly 30-plus other sites that are simply historic houses, or, you know, freedom trails like through Boston, the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides as we know it. You have Statue of Liberty. There are a whole bunch of different sites. So the National Park Service is really entrusted with both the natural and historical heritage of the nation. And, of course, historical structures are as difficult to maintain as large natural landscapes.
Congressman Richard Pombo from California, who's head of the House Committee on Resources, has proposed some pretty radical, quote-unquote, solutions to the underfunding of the parks. And one of them is to sell off some parks, and another is to allow commercial interests to sponsor them. Can you explain what's going on and what this means for the parks, these proposals?
I think Richard Pombo has had several novel attempts to try to get at the National Park Service system. The most egregious one is his notion of selling off park units that don't have a certain number of visits during the year. And, of course, what that means, once one translates into a bigger picture, is either selling off units which are so underfunded they've been unable to attract people, or the other ones that come up, of course, some large tracks up in Alaska that are very difficult for people to get to, but which honestly hold some of the nation's greatest natural jewels. So either of those scenarios is absolutely absurd. But we believe that people are coming around to Pombo's game, and I think most of Congress is beginning to drum him out of business.
I know he's facing what might be a tough reelection campaign, but just focusing on your last statement that Congress might be coming to realize that Pombo doesn't necessarily have the best answers for the national parks, so is it no longer such a threat of selling it off in pieces, and the main threat now is just the lack of funding in general?
I think the greatest danger out of Pombo's efforts has not been that Pombo's particular plans themselves are a threat. What he's done is try to move the bar so people think, oh, well, we'll do something in the middle and that's better. And the problem is the something in the middle is still dramatically underfunding the national parks. And as that happens, you cannot go back in and fix something that has been inalterably ruined. You cannot go back in and, you know, recreate Old Ironsides if she sinks to the bottom of Boston Harbor. You cannot go back in and, you know, recreate the bridge that the Minutemen launched America from in Concord. And that, honestly, is a real danger because the national park system holds those American icons, both natural and cultural, which are not just special, I think, for what they are by themselves, but all these icons are special because they bring to, I believe, a broad array of Americans the different trails that we have all walked to get here and to forge our nation. And if you lose that memory, that cognizance of the nation, we will lose the bonds that tie us together.
That was Alexander Brash of the National Parks Conservation Association. Call the organization at area code 212-454-3311 or visit their website at www.npca.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be focusing on the U.S. occupation of Iraq on that day, which is the third anniversary of the U.S.'s invasion. We'll also feature an interview of Malala Joy, a 27-year-old woman who recently won a seat in the Afghan parliament. Today, she was speaking in Dover, New Hampshire, and we're excited to give you all the opportunity to hear her message next week. We leave you with this quote by Audre Lorde: "Where the words of women are crying to be heard, we must each of us recognize our responsibility to seek those words out, to read them and share them and examine them in their pertinence to our lives, that we not hide behind the mockeries of separations that have been imposed upon us and which we so often accept as our own."